Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network.
You're listening to the newchurches.com Q&A podcast. New Churches is an online hub for the mission of church multiplication. Here you'll find the resources and training you need to get started, as well as a community of church planting and multi-site experts to help you thrive. My name is Daniel Im, and today we're going to be playing for you an episode that we recorded for the Five Leadership Questions podcast. Now, this is with Todd Adkins and I, and he interviews me on the most common lie leaders believe and what to do about it. So if you haven't listened into this episode yet on the Five Leadership Questions podcast, here you go.
All right. So we're continuing our series on lies leaders believe. And I would say, Daniel, I'm ready to talk about the greatest lie that leaders believe. I know you and I both share the sentiment that this is the number one lie. So why don't you break it down for us?
Yeah, it's the name of the book. It's the name of the book. You are what you do. And even as I was with B&H trying to figure out what are we going to call this book, we're like, why don't we just call it by the lie that really most of us, I mean, especially in a Western context, are conditioned to believe, right? I mean, you are what you do. The subtitle of the book is super important, and six other lies about work, life, and love. But really, when you think about this lie, you are what you do, as children, we're asked what we want to do when we grow up, right? That's where it begins. As adults, we're asked what we do for work. And in certain countries, it's asked quicker and sooner than others. And if it takes longer for it to be asked, I think we're all trying to size the other person up. Not to say that that's a good thing, but that our minds kind of go there, right? And we're asked what we do for work. And based on their answer, they kind of go up or down the social scale or whatever other paradigm we think about. I mean, isn't that why Jesus said what he said as it relates to don't judge people by their outward appearance and don't try to sit at, you know, the right-hand side, and anyways, all the stuff that he talked about. And then at the end of our lives, aren't we measured by what we've done? I mean, this is where the lie comes from.
The obit.
Core lie.
Yeah. The obituary.
Oh yeah, completely, completely.
I do think it's interesting to go back to the very beginning of your, when you started out, you said, hey, you're asked, what do you want to do when you grow up? I think the more common question and telling question is, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Interesting.
So what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And then somebody will say, a firefighter.
Well, okay.
It's like, I'm already conditioning you to find your identity in what you do.
Oh, wow.
From the very beginning.
Dude, that's
you should
so
put
good.
That in the book, Daniel.
No kidding. Too bad it's already out. Maybe second edition.
Second edition. No, but it's true,
that's
isn't
really
it?
Really good.
I mean, what do you want to be when you grow up?
That's so good. Yeah. And we're human beings. We're human beings. We're not human doings. And for me, as an Enneagram 3, and I didn't integrate the Enneagram into the book at all because Christina right. and I are still learning about it. But as I flesh it out and dig a little bit deeper into the Enneagram, I'm like, oh my goodness, every single one of these lies is likely more appealing to one of the numbers than not. And I wonder if the name of the book is You Are What You Do, because that's the core lie of the of Enneagram 3s, and that's what I am. So it's
fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is.
We've actually got Ian Cron coming up on the podcast.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to be really... And speaking of Janae, who's really nice, you should see her when somebody else has put their name in to co-host with Ian Cron instead of her. There's no hello going on there.
Yeah, no way.
she's foot sweeping people and taking them to the floor.
That is awesome. That is awesome.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about this. I mean, I am going to try to refrain from one-liners.
Okay.
Because I have so many one-liners on this doing thing, doing versus developing, you know, all the stuff in the church. How do we almost immediately see this play out in the church.
Yeah. Well, doing has become a badge of honor. Doing is a status symbol, and doing has become the way to define ourselves. And we see that at any conference or gathering of pastors that you go to, we go to how big is your church. And if you're not as bold enough to ask that, and I hate when that's asked, but if you're not bold enough to ask that, everyone's trying to figure it out anyway. And it's right in the back of their head. So we go straight there, not because we think that everything's going to be better and our conversation is going to be better when we do that, but it's just become such a part of who we are. So, I mean, we see it even from that, right? From the introductions.
Oh, totally. And for instance, writing a book, Daniel.
Yeah.
A lot of people will be like, well, I don't really have anything to say until I write a book. Do you know what I'm, thinking? Or not what I'm thinking. What I'm saying is, in my head, the lie I believe is until I write a book, I really don't have anything to say.
Interesting. Interesting. And it's even a, there's even a stratosphere or a class within that. Right. So
right.
Books have become the new business card. But
oh, and then it's who's your publisher?
Yes. And if it's self-published. Yeah. Then there's a stratosphere. Yeah. And yeah, there is that in that. And then it's who is your publisher? Okay, you have a publisher. Are they a hybrid publisher? Are they this? Are they that? Or and then I mean it's stupid. It's absolutely stupid how we go there. And not everyone, I mean, writing a book is incredibly long and arduous and difficult to do. So, but, and it's absolutely not true that if you don't write a book, you don't have any good ideas. That's not true at all. Yet
it's a lie we believe.
It is a lie we believe. Yeah.
So, okay. You know, going back into the, church context, I think what's interesting to me is, you know, our listeners would know I will frequently go to Ephesians 2:8-9, Ephesians 2:10. Mm-hmm. And how do you balance the fact that Ephesians 2:10 says we're God's workmanship and there's specific things that he's prepared in advance for us to do?
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting away from doing, right? And even for me as a 3 on the Enneagram, I mean, I'm an achiever and I like checking things off. And even behind this, on my computer right now, I have a bunch of checkboxes for things that I need to do today and things that I need to continue to do for my book and my calendar's full.
I just have
that.
14 windows open.
I got lots of windows open too. You must have like given that to me. It must have just rubbed off on working with you. But there's a lot that we need to do, right? There is, and we can't get away from that. But where do you find your identity? Is your identity on the things that you do and the things that you've done and the things that you're going to do? Or is your identity on what Jesus has done for you? And is that enough? There's a huge difference on that. And that's why Ephesians 2, there's 8 and 9 come before 10. 8 and 9 is what Christ has done for us. And then doing is then a response in verse 10.
Right. It's not by works, but at the same time, he's got stuff for me to do.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
It's understanding that yes, it's a free gift, but it comes with responsibility.
Yeah. I love what Tim Keller wrote. This was a New York Times article and I'll just read it for you. And it's all about the way that we place our identity in what we do. Here's what he said. So many college students do not choose work that actually fits their abilities, talents, and capacities, but rather choose work that fits within their limited imagination of how they can boost their own self-image. There were only 3 high-status kinds of jobs: those that paid well, those that directly worked on society's needs, and those that had the cool factor. Because there is no longer an operative consensus on the dignity of all work, still less on the idea that in all work we are the hands and fingers of God serving the human community. In their minds, they had an extremely limited range of career choices. That means lots of young adults are choosing work that doesn't fit them or fields that are too highly competitive for most people to do well in. And this sets many people up for a sense of dissatisfaction or meaningless in their work, right? I mean, we've been conditioned, in other words, both from within and without, to over-identify ourselves with our jobs. And we think that when we get that job, that great thing that we can finally add to our resume or the letters after our name, the title, whatever that is, we think that that's going to satisfy that internal craving for meaning. And that's what all this is driven for or driven by, and our drive for a particular quality of life. But when we find that job that boosts our self-image and pays the bills, I mean, or if we even ever find that job, and if we don't, that's why the gig economy exists, right? If we don't find one that pays all the bills, then we just get a side hustle here, a gig there. And that doesn't hurt anyone, right? Just get another thing that you do. And that's kind of how the cycle gets perpetuated in why we believe that we are what we do.
On this podcast, we equip our listeners with the absolute best resources to help their churches thrive. So if you're looking at launching a thriving church in a rented venue or perhaps a new one that you own, I would encourage you to check out the team at Portable Church. Portable Church Industries equips churches meeting in alternative venues with total solutions so that you can launch strong, be reproductive, and thrive in your community. For over 25 years, they've partnered with church planters and multi-site leaders, mastering creative, intelligent, and effective portable church solutions so that you and your team can stay focused on the thing that really matters, and that's building disciples. If you want to see what this looks like, visit portablechurch.com/flyport. How has this continued to shift in culture? Like, where do you see this? Where do you see this going? Is the pendulum almost shifted? Is it going to shift further?
Well, there's three unintended consequences when we believe this lie that we are what we do. Three unintended consequences when this is the primary lens in which we measure ourselves, when our being is defined by our doing. The first thing, the first unintended consequence is that we're going to feel an enormous amount of pressure to do more so that we can get more, have more, and be more. But it's kind of like laundry. It never ends, right?
Right.
The dishes, you've done it. And then you're like, oh my goodness, why is there so much more to do? And it just doing more and accomplishing more then leads us to have more pressure to do more and be more and have more and get more. So there's this pressure that believing this lie, the unintended consequence of pressure. The other unintended consequence is platforming. The lie that we believe that, hey, in order for me to do more and be more and get more, I need to have a platform. I need to have a platform. And yes, platforms in and of themselves are neutral, but the problem is that desiring for and building your life on getting that platform often opens the door to a compartmentalized life. What ends up happening is you then begin separating your private and public life. And as it grows over the years, fewer and fewer people are let in on the inside because you have to create this persona, this platform as to who you want the world to be. So even when you look at what you post on it, on social media or on Instagram, you're like, well, I can't post that. That's too real. That's my inner. So it's going to go against this public life. And that's why, right? That is why it was so shocking to hear of Robin Williams committing suicide, right? It was so shocking to hear of Anthony Bourdain's and Kate Spade's suicides as well, right? We're like, whoa, look at their platform. Look at all that they've done. Look at all that they've achieved. If I only do what they do and get what they have, then I'm going to be as satisfied as them. But there was such a divide between their inner and outer world that, I mean, it's unfortunately it ended up the way it did. So those are two of the unintended consequences, pressure and platform. The third unintended consequence is that we're going to pretend. Because if we can't keep up with the pressure and building a platform isn't going as well as you thought, then the next best option seems to be just to pretend, right? We think right. You got to fake it till you make it. You got to buy followers on social media. You know, you're going to, and here's the thing. I love listening to the podcast, How I Built This. And right. When you listen to that, you're like, oh my goodness, all these startups, so many of them faked it till they made it. They padded their numbers. They paid people to purchase their products. They did all that. And not all of them, obviously, but you're like, well, if it worked for them, then, and if they hacked their way to success, then it probably works for me too. Right. But the problem with pretending is that it always leads to anxiety because you're always looking over your shoulder and you're like, well, when am I going to be found out? When are people going to finally figure out that I'm a fake? And that's where you get the whole idea of the imposter syndrome.
Hmm. Okay. You know, based on that idea of pretending, we both have experienced and some of the mutual friends, we both have experienced the tragedy that happens when somebody does fall. How does that come about?
Yeah, there's implosion that happens, right? And our friend Eric Geiger, your boss, your former boss, my boss's boss, boss daddy, now in California. I mean, he wrote a book, right? How to Ruin Your Life?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it right now. The black cover. It's
a great book.
It's such a great book.
I don't know that enough people read it for it to like catch, but it is a really good book for leaders.
Yeah. And it talks
about how not to ruin your life how to ruin your life.
He talks about how not to.
Anyway,
essentially
he talks about how not to.
Yeah. So when you think about it that way, there's implosion that happened and how did it happen? There is a divide between their inner and outer life, right? That second unintended consequence of needing to build a platform. There is this pressure that kept on building up to do more, to be more, to get more. And here's the crazy thing about this. All right. I remember having a conversation with a pastor who their friend was like literally high flying. They're going to fly to Geneva and then to London and then go on a yacht. And then like, literally that's what they do in a week. And it's just, oh yeah, of course. And then they're going to have big parties here and there. And they're in that social class, that upper echelon, you know, the echelon stratosphere of society. And here's the thing, they weren't always there. But when they were getting close and they were invited into that, then it was a new level of friends. It was a new level of life. And I'm like, literally, who in the world flies from one vacation destination part of Europe to a completely different part of Europe after only having a dinner in Geneva? Like just having dinner in Geneva. And you're like, oh, okay, now it's time to go back to London. And maybe I'll go back to Geneva tomorrow evening if I want, but I'm just going to take my private helicopter or my private plane. Like who lives like that other than James Bond? Who's not?
I don't know.
Yeah. But when you're in that upper echelon, that's the life that you're like, well, I need to now have my own private jet because who flies coach? Who flies commercial? When there was a day where you were like, oh my goodness, I got bumped up to premium economy, right? And then you get to first class and you're like, oh, who flies premium economy? Well, that's the problem with this lie and believing this lie and the pressure that gets built up. And then all of a sudden you find yourself pretending, right? Because you're faking it till you make it. And it just keeps on building. And that divide between your inner and outer life continues to grow until you just can't hold it anymore. You can't go on anymore. And that's where we see these implosions happen.
Well, yeah. And then you tell it so often and it becomes so ingrained into, you know, who you are. You believe it yourself.
Yeah. And so then let me just quickly go on that point. What's really interesting is when you look at these individuals that did fall and that did catch and, you know, that were caught in multiple years of adultery or whatever addiction that they've had, they weren't the longer they lived in it, the higher they got up in it. They actually, a lot of them wanted to be found out. It was like a cry for help. and they weren't as right. diligent in keeping the secrets because they couldn't stand the divide between the inner and outer life. And they just wanted it all to come crashing down. And it's interesting how it's kind of, they begin opening the door to this because the pressure's too much to hold up.
Hmm. Okay. So I do want to talk about that a little bit because, you know, there's been pastors in press and other places where, or just ones that we know that may not be, you know, on a national scale, but they're known. How does somebody come back from this? So I think part of this is not just what you do, but the lie that you are what you've done. Mm. I mean, I can remember early in ministry, with Satan on my shoulder saying, who are you to talk to these students? Do you remember what you were doing when you were in high school? You know, that lie that you cannot get over or come back from something that you've done, that God can't, you know, make that a redemptive story or redemptive part of your story.
Yeah, this is why the scriptures are so incredible, especially the life of David. And that's a story that Eric talks about in his book. And he talks about, you know, David's adultery and his life and what all that happened. But David was incredibly meaningful for me too. I remember early on in ministry where the ministry was growing in Montreal and Christina and I loved it there. And I mean, it was incredible. The evangelistic effectiveness of the church. And I mean, we just loved being a part of the church. And then I was invited onto staff of a church in Korea that had 50,000 people. And it was like, I would be an absolute idiot to say no to this opportunity. Like, who in the world
right.
gets to pastor at a church of 50,000 people? So it was, I so believed this lie that I was what I did and that I was like, well, regardless of how long we stay there, I mean, it's on my resume and there's just, you know, it just kind of went on like that. And God's so gracious. He's so gracious. We went and the ministry was growing. It was fruitful. It was incredible. But then it all came crashing down and it was taken away. And I was even discerning, am I even called to the ministry in the first place? And it all came crashing down and we moved back to Canada. And I talk about this story in the book. This is actually the first time I've really talked about what happened in Korea because we didn't really want to talk about it. It was so fresh. But I talk about it a few times in the book. And when I came down and I actually was invited to a retreat in Calgary to speak to young adults there. And I was trying to figure out what to preach on. And in the meantime, we were jobless, homeless, moneyless, everything. All three of Christina and I and our first daughter, Victoria, all living in one little room in my parents' house in Vancouver while our savings kept on going down, down, down. And I put my resume everywhere. Literally, I was like, okay, I'm going to put my resume to this little small church who, I mean, they would like, it would be a dream for them to hire me. I mean, with everything that I've done, this is like, whatever, it's just going to be my backup option. And literally for 5 months, no one called me back. No one called me back. And as I was preparing for that retreat to speak at that retreat, I was, I audited this course at Regent College with Eugene Peterson. It was an audio course that he had done in the past, but basically he walked through the life of David and I was like, oh my goodness, I am putting on Saul's armor. I am Saul. I am living my life based on my accomplishments and all of this. And I realized that God called me out of that into the desert. And when you compare the life of David and the life of Saul, what's fascinating is that one of the biggest differences is that David went to the desert and he was in the desert multiple times, where Saul wasn't, at least not that what was recorded. And for David, after he was anointed as king and after he was called to be king and God's favor was abundantly on him, he was in the desert. And it was in that desert that God shaped his character, deepened his prayer life, made him into the man that he was. And yeah, David messed up. He messed up, royally messed up. Yet he had that soft heart that prayer life that God so developed in him through those desert moments that Saul did not have. So I realized for me, and I'm going back to, I know there was a long-winded way of answering your question, but it's those desert moments. It's how do we maintain soft hearts? How do we maintain soft hearts no matter what our accomplishments are and what we've done or what our resume is, regardless of how big your church is or how small it is? How do we find our identity in what Christ has done for us, not in what we are doing, and remain nimble and humble and soft in, you know, just coming before the Lord daily, not with our titles, but simply as a child of God, and just come with that? Because I think if we do that, and we continually do that, then regardless of what comes our way, we're going to have that right heart.
I love that. I love that. And honestly, I think that's a great place for us to wrap up, simply because if you look around and you look at guys that we know that have gotten shrouded out of the saddle, it is that compartmentalization of their life. But also I think it is that contriteness that they do start to believe their own press, or they just get so shut off that, you know, their heart is an echo chamber. And they don't take the time to daily repentance. That's what I think keeps your heart soft and contrite, is if there's something, you have something to repent for pretty much on every hour, I would think, if you're anything like me.
Yeah.
But making sure that that is part of, you know, your daily process has to be key.
Yeah. So good. So good.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Thank you for listening, and please hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review.
It is now well known that planting new churches and campuses is the most effective way of reaching the lost, and launching in rented venues like schools or theaters is one of the most cost-effective ways to launch a new church. So if you're planning a launch or are trying to figure out how to do church well in rented venues, we encourage you to check out our friends at Portable Church. The team at Portable Church Industries takes your vision and creates engaging environments that keep volunteer retention high and allow more energy to be spent on ministry. Go to portablechurch.com/lifeway to learn more and find free customized resources that teach how to launch portable and strong.